The devastating flood of June 1972 had an unforgettable impact on Rapid City, South Dakota, and the surrounding area, both physically and emotionally. Now, as we approach the 50th anniversary of the event, we'd like to take the opportunity to look back and reflect. In this series of podcasts, we will examine archival materials, revisit witness accounts, and hear firsthand from some of the survivors themselves. This is The Flood of 72, 50 years later. In this episode, we meet Michael E. Dennis, who had recently turned 18 and was spending a night out among friends, unaware of the disaster that would befall them.
This is the account of Michael E. Dennis. I had just graduated from high school and was working for a small construction company. It was Friday night, I had gotten my first paycheck, and was driving around in my 1962 Chevy panel truck, buying t-shirts and window shopping. It had started raining hard before dark, and now water was running several inches deep in the streets. I picked up a friend, Jim Clay, who had just finished his shift at the Pizza Hut on West Main. We drove around, killing time until later when I had agreed to give a co-worker a ride to Blackhawk from the Alibi Bar near the intersection of West Omaha and Mountain View Road. About 10:30 p.m., we pulled into the parking lot of the Alibi and went inside looking for the co-worker, his name forgotten. I'll call him Leroy. Although I wasn't old enough to be there, I lingered a few minutes waiting for my co-worker to finish his beer. People were looking out the back door facing Rapid Creek. Suddenly, water was coming in the back door, and the bartender yelled, "The bar was closed, and everyone had to leave, quote, now." We ran to my truck, jumped in. Leroy in the passenger seat, Jim in the back, pulled out of the parking lot on Omaha, pointing west. Hard rain and slapping windshield wipers limited my visibility, but headlights and streetlights lit the area. We didn't travel far. The street became tangled with cars leaving the bar, trucks pulling travel trailers out of an adjacent sales lot, and vehicles attempting to turn around and head back east. I was hemmed in, and the water was rising fast.
On June 9th and 10th, 1972, extremely heavy rains over the eastern Black Hills of South Dakota produced record flooding of Rapid Creek and other streams in the area. Nearly 15 inches of rain fell in about 6 hours near Nemo, and more than 10 inches of rain fell over an area of 60 square miles. Michael and his friends knew they had to get out of the raging waters and to higher ground.
I felt confused by what was happening around us. Movement on the street had come to a standstill as traffic stalled in the rising water. I became preoccupied with keeping the engine running, and water splashed around my ankles as I pumped the gas pedal. To my left, on the south side of Omaha Street, the shapes of mobile homes were visible, slowly moving and turning. That area was below street level, and the dozens of mobile homes were beginning to float. Then my truck's engine died. As I tried to start it, water splashed around my knees. Then everything on the street was moving, and we were drifting backward. It all happened quickly, and although the sequence is not clear, the images remain sharp and strong. Intense rain, the deafening sound of rushing water, and lightning every few seconds. By itself, the lightning storm was memorable because it created a strobe effect, reflecting off the rain and the water, freezing images my mind tried to sort out before another strobe flash altered the scene. My anxiety was rising, but I didn't panic. The slow drift halted temporarily on a slight rise, maybe the curbing of a long curve. A blue double cab pickup was parallel to our vehicle, to the right, the north. A man in the driver's seat was yelling over to us, but I couldn't hear him over the roar of the water. I asked Leroy what he was saying. Leroy turned to me, shouting to be heard, and said, "He says we have to swim for it." We turned our heads back toward the man, who then slipped into the water and disappeared from view. In the back of our truck, Jim asked, "We have to swim?" I shouted back to him, "No." Jim said, "Good. I can't swim." In front of us, illuminated by the headlights, was a man, his back to us, arms stretched up against a small travel trailer, trying to keep his balance as the trailer pushed him toward us. Then he was crushed between the trailer and the front end of my truck. The trailer moved slightly to the left, and he, thankfully still moving, made his way to our right. The man made his way along to the side of the truck. Jim helped him into the back. Amazingly, he seemed all right. Force of the water kept pushing the trailer into the truck. The hood slowly began to bend upward, and the metal groaned as it buckled. Then a crack appeared at the lower left of my windshield. It spread, and suddenly the entire windshield shattered. Then something happened to me. In that instant of the breaking glass, I believe I moved beyond anything like confusion, panic, or fear. My emotions became suppressed, and I was aware, clear-headed, simply reacting. I vaulted over the seat into the back of the truck where I crouched, scanning the front. Leroy remained in his passenger seat, the water up to his waist. The trailer peeled away to the left, and we were moving backwards again. I felt a hard slap from the left and realized the wood panel had hit me. I bent the paneling upward, could see a hole through the side of the truck. A mobile home riding high in the water had grazed our side, slicing metal from behind the driver's window to the rear door. My truck, with us in it, continued moving backwards.
KOTA Radio and other radio and television stations had given storm updates. As reports of streams west of Rapid City being flooded came in, Rapid City Mayor Don Barnett advised all residents whose homes abutted Rapid Creek to abandon their homes immediately and seek higher ground. But many people had already gone to bed or, like Michael, were not watching TV or listening to the radio.
We had been picking up speed, but now we stopped, still facing west. We had come to rest against debris that was piling up along a line of small trees. Jim, the rescued man, and I exited the back of the truck and onto the trees. Freed from the limited space of the panel truck, the world around us seemed more comprehensible. We were on the north side of a billboard that was on the north side of Omaha Street. The billboard lights were still on. Mobile homes had broken against the three steel I-beam supports, and accumulating debris was making a breakwater, protecting a small house behind it. Small, closely spaced elm trees ran to the north from the house. A gas station, Frontier, was nearby to the northwest. As I held onto a tree, several things were happening at once. To my left, I could see Jim and the other man moving toward the house. Several other people were in the trees to my right and moving from tree to tree toward me. Leroy was still in the truck. He climbed out of the passenger's door window, had his arms on the roof but could not get a handhold. The power line feeding the billboard fell into the water near him. It whipped and snapped, temporarily live in the water, and Leroy screamed. I jumped back onto the roof of the truck, helped Leroy up, and then climbed back into the tree. At the same time, a Volkswagen Bug and another car had washed against the gas station. A man was climbing from the submerged VW to the roof of the station. Mobile home slammed sideways against the cars and the station. A second mobile home slammed against it. Then the station gave way. The man jumped from the roof onto the first trailer. Then, as the three structures began to gather speed, he jumped to the second trailer, and finally from the second trailer toward the trees. I made my way a short distance along the trees toward the house. An old Ford van was floating, bobbing in the calm water between the billboard and the house. The water was near the eaves of the house. It was an easy climb, using the van to get to the roof.
A photograph provided by Mr. Dennis shows the billboard and trees that he mentions in his account. They stand amidst rubble and wreckage in the foreground. The house is in the background, with only the roof visible. A similar photograph, taken from a slightly different angle, is included in the book, Turning Point, Remembering the Black Hills Flood of 1972. The billboard, which withstood the floodwaters, reads, Gas Grill Ready to Heat, When You're Ready to Eat, $5 per month, MDU.
In all, there were about nine of us gathered on that roof. Jim, Leroy, myself, the man from the Volkswagen, the rescued man, and two others who had been helping him with the trailers, plus a couple more that I can't specifically remember. We were a miserable bunch and in a precarious spot. The water was up to the roof of the house, and we were on one of the few standing buildings. We were soaked and shivering involuntarily with the cold. We also shivered, even if we didn't acknowledge it to each other, or even ourselves, from shock and fear. We had a wide and terrible view of Rapid City's gap between M Hill and Dinosaur Hill. By now the electricity had gone out, but the scene was fully illuminated by the lightning and partially lit by a fire to the south. I thought it was coming from near Warren Chemical. Smoke from the fire spread over the area, provided an eerie, diffuse light. Across the street to the south, spread among large cottonwoods, were small houses and motorhomes. You could see those closest to the street collapse one by one. I will never forget one house, a flashlight, scanning wildly inside while it disappeared into the dark water. Water was rushing through a large steel building to the southeast, Rice Cycle, I believe, but the second story stood immovable, above the water, even as mobile homes slammed into the structure. No buildings were visible among the trees to the east of us. The mobile homes caused us great anxiety. There were trailer sales lots on both sides of Omaha Street to the west of us. Within our view, trailers cut through buildings and exploded against trees. We were directly in the path of many of them. After gathering speed, they would either break against the billboard or be slightly diverted by a wave extending from the breakwater, just missing the southeast corner of the house, which was still exposed to the swift water current. As the trailers raced past, the house would shudder, seemingly ready to collapse. As the trailers approached, we'd gather at the roof edge, ready to leap toward the billboard. But somehow, the house withstood. Sitting on that roof, helpless, wet, and shivering, watching the raging water full of debris and even people floating by, I thought I should probably pray. But it wasn't in my heart. There was nothing to do but shiver and wait in silence.
According to the Red Cross, the total damage included 1,335 homes and 5,000 automobiles destroyed. Caught in the floodwaters of Rapid Creek, Michael's group was lucky to find shelter that ensured their survival. Others nearby who had not left the area were not so lucky. Michael's group wasn't in the clear yet. Fearing hypothermia, the desperate survivors had to find a way to get warm.
After a time, maybe about 2 hours, the water had receded several feet, and desperate for shelter, we broke out an attic window and climbed into the house. We were thankful to be in a warm, dry space. Someone found a flashlight. The attic was used as a bedroom and had steep, narrow stairs running down to the kitchen. We sat or lay down, wrapping ourselves in blankets, sheets, and clothing. I remember someone examined the man who had been crushed between my truck and the trailer. He had cuts along the ridges of his pelvis, but they weren't bleeding much. Borrowing the flashlight, I ventured downstairs, encountering mud on the steps. Water was still up to the countertops, the kitchen a jumble of debris. I saw a live snake on top of one pile. Retreating back to the attic, I pulled on a dry coat, lay back, and slept for a short time. Before dawn, we could see headlights to the east, backed up along Omaha. The water was still several feet deep near the house, and the vehicles didn't proceed. Stopped headlights were also visible to the west of the bridge over Rapid Creek. As it became light, we began leaving, wading out through the running water. My friend Jim suffered from asthma and was having trouble breathing and couldn't leave with me. He asked me to find him some medicine, so I headed toward Bennett Clarkson Hospital. At times, the swift water was above my knees, and the footing was treacherous. As I approached the intersection of West Main and Mountain View Road, I kept to the east, skirting deeper water. The front of the Safeway was gone, and debris had piled inside the back wall of the store. The first floor of the hospital was full of muck. I followed a nurse through the muck to the pharmacy, where she tried to locate asthma medicine. It was a difficult task because mud was on every shelf, and the narrow pillars on top of every container. She found some pills, and I made my way back. What Jim really needed was an inhaler. Every few steps away from the house, we stopped for him to rest. We headed west. When we got to Mountain View, a high school classmate and his girlfriend pulled up in a car. I couldn't believe they were driving around. His car was jacked up, riding above the water. I helped Jim into his car and they left. I continued west along Omaha Street, crossing the partially collapsed bridge by holding onto the submerged railing. On the opposite side, a man in a 50s vintage truck gave me a ride to my family's house on Hall Street.
Michael visited Bennett Clarkson Memorial Hospital at 915 Mountain View Road. The building is still in operation. Longtime Rapid City residents might call it Regional West, though it recently rebranded as Monument Health Behavioral Health Center. After helping his friend, Michael was finally able to go home, but his adrenaline wouldn't let him rest.
When I walked in the back door, my mother was greatly relieved. But I couldn't stay still. After eating some breakfast, my brothers and I walked to the Meadowbrook area to see what we could do. Later that day, I was standing in our kitchen, and my knees started shaking. I dropped to the floor. The magnitude of the experience had finally overwhelmed my fatigued defenses. I recovered my truck a few days later, and it sat in front of our house before it was towed away for salvage. I had never written about the flood until 2005. After the flood, when I began sharing my story with others, usually over beer or a long ride across South Dakota, the sequence of events, the images, the sounds, even smells were especially clear. The telling sometimes took an hour. As I recreated through words the truly horrible reality of what had happened, my emotions would surface, causing my voice to crack and my eyes to tear. I had not felt these things during the actual experience. Over time, one's memory fades and details are lost, but I have always been careful in telling my story not to embellish, because the experience was powerful enough to preserve the core of it. I may have remembered some things wrongly. It's difficult to correct those. There are some things I heard afterward, from Leroy, for instance, who said someone the next morning had pulled a little girl alive out of a tree near the house. I don't remember that. I can't say if it's true or not true.
1720 West Omaha, where Michael and his companions found refuge, no longer exists as a residence. The area is now a disc golf course on the south side of the street and a park adjacent to Rapid Creek on the north side. This area is part of the Special Flood Hazard Area, shown on the city's flood map, which is known as the 100-year floodplain.
When I wrote this, I did not trust memory alone. Several weeks ago, I spent a week in Rapid City visiting my family. For an hour or two each day, I researched at the city library. I also visited the flood display at the Journey Museum, dug out a pre-flood aerial photograph at the city planning office, interviewed several people, and carefully walked over the West Omaha area. Using the aerial photograph as a map, I labeled the address of each house and building within a few hundred feet of 1720 West Omaha, the house which provided us refuge. I also marked the residences of flood victims. The area is now open space, but many cottonwoods visible on the aerial photograph are still present. Two elms survive from the line of small trees that were next to the house. A picture of the billboard, taken Saturday the 10th, was printed in the Rapid City Journal on June 12, 1972, on page 5. Another picture showing the house and the billboard was printed in a report, Black Hills Flood of June 9, 1972, Midwest Research Publishers, on page 166. There are other published photographs, and one on the internet showing nearby businesses and scenes along Omaha Street. I spoke with Sally Liebig, the woman who rented the house. She and her daughter had left about 10:30 p.m., traveling to Blackhawk at the urging of her father. When she returned, her house was the only one left standing. She said she went inside but salvaged nothing. Sally recalled that all her clocks had stopped either 5 minutes before or 5 minutes after 11 p.m. That was likely the time my truck came to rest next to the billboard. Coincidentally, the man in the VW was her former brother-in-law, Don Hip Liebig. He was bartending that night at the Alibi. Don told me there was a good crowd at the bar because the stock car races had been rained out. When his VW washed against the gas station, Don was temporarily trapped inside until a Rambler station wagon crashed into the rear window, flooding the interior, but also allowing him to open a door and climb onto the station. He spent that night distraught over what might have happened to his girlfriend. She survived further east on Omaha Street. I thought the smoke from that night was coming from Warren Chemical. I spoke to Mrs. Warren, whose home had been adjacent to the business. She told me that the fire was at the house of a neighbor, Essie Bowman, 1707 West Rapid Street. She was badly burned before she was persuaded to go through the water to safety. I also spoke with Darrell Wiley, who owned the Frontier gas station next to the house. He said that a picket fence ran along the east side of the station property, and he parked used cars for sale along the fence. Pushed by the flood against the steel beams of the billboard, these cars became the foundation of the breakwater protecting the house. He and his brother Don tried to remove some of the cars, but they gave up due to the rising water. Darrell also lost a restored Model T Ford, of which he only found the trunk lid. The house across the street that disappeared while a flashlight desperately waved around inside may have belonged to Louise Sprague. That would have been at 1713 West Omaha. Three flood victims, Albert and Mary Buchholz and Edna Schuster, resided near her at 1709 and 1731 West Omaha. At least three other victims, Donald, Doris, and Henry Hausman, lived at 1611 West St. Louis, within a block of Sally Liebig. Don't know the man who slipped into the water from the blue pickup. For some reason, I have always associated that truck with Major G. William Medley, the Salvation Army. Others doubtless perished near my location. I did not know these people, but I feel connected to them.
William G. Medley was a major and commander of the Rapid City Salvation Army. He perished in his truck while trying to save others when the Canyon Lake Dam broke. He was 50. Medley was survived by his wife, one son and one daughter, and buried in the Salvation Army plot, Glen Oak Cemetery, Hillside, Illinois. There is no proof that Medley was the man in the truck that Michael saw.
The USGS estimated the peak flow that night at 50,000 cubic feet per second. All that water funneled through a 1/3 mile wide gap while we watched from the roof of Sally Liebig's house. Everything in the water was battered and torn to pieces. Thankfully, the progress of my Chevy panel truck along Omaha had been blocked by the traffic jam. Otherwise, we may have been swept off the bridge over into Rapid Creek, had we made it that far. What luck allowed us nine to drift into the debris and trees near that billboard? How did that house stand against the volume of water and all those mobile homes? Our survival in such a compromised location was pure chance. I was 18. The thought that I could die had never crossed my mind. I didn't consider my experience as life-affirming or life-changing. However, the flood did affect me immediately in several ways. In addition to becoming emotional talking about it, I could not sleep on rainy nights, nor would I enter dark or swift water. Sometimes driving at night, if I passed a bridge or an overpass, I'd be surprised by the sudden nearness of the object in my headlights, and I'd begin shaking, my mind seeing again objects looming in the strobe effect of lightning from that night. Now, in middle age, I'm beyond that, mostly. My wife, Stephanie, says that my hands still sweat when I get involved in the telling of this story. Michael E. Dennis, June 2005.
We thank Michael Dennis for providing us with such a compelling and richly detailed account of his experiences the night of and in the aftermath of the flood of 72. Mr. Dennis granted us permission to perform a reading of his account for the purpose of this podcast. If you or someone you know has a personal account of their experiences during the flood of 72 that they would like to share, we would like to hear your story. Contact the Rapid City Public Library at 605-394-6139 or email ask@rcplib.org.